Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum on Vox Pop. And today we welcome back our panel of experts to the program to field your scientific questions. Give us a call now, 800-348-2551. The scientists are looking for applause, so I'll give them a round of applause. 800-348-2551 is the number. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the phone number, once again, 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll get to it right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and the experts are here champing at the bit to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you may email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email address. And then to recap the phone number, it's 800-348-2551. All right, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hello, it's Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
Hello.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Hi.
And I'm Ed Stander, and I'm not a chemist.
What do you do?
I do astronomy, geology, environmental science, and pretty well anything that these guys can't answer.
All right, before the phone calls start, I know we had some homework on the last program about gin and duck calls, not at the same time. Please refresh my memory. I vaguely remember the duck calls. I forget what the problem was with gin.
You forget the gin thing?
I don't have a problem with gin, so I forget what the problem was.
Well, maybe that's the problem.
Well, you make a point. And also, I thought your idea about having a silence forum was pretty good. So,
oh, there we go.
Maybe we'll do that one of these
experts.
Days. All right, so what was the homework?
Okay, I'll start with the ducks. The question was, do ducks, when they quack out in the woods, do they make echoes?
Oh, yes.
I think it was mallards, even in particular.
In
it was
particular,
mallards.
Yes. And so I did some research and discovered that someplace out in California, they had taken ducks and they put them in an anechoidal chamber, which is similar to one we're in right now, with walls that don't reflect sound.
Yeah.
And they recorded the duck, and then they brought the duck calls into a church and saw if they got any reflections from the walls of the church from the ducks.
Of course, they would.
And they didn't get... Well, they got something, yes. They said, it sounded like a duck, it looked like a duck, and it probably was a duck.
Oh, that was a long lead-in.
Now, yeah. I'll tell you on top of that I live next to a large lake with Canada geese. Now, geese are not ducks. They're different.
You make a point.
Right? Ducks have only four letters in their names. Geese have five.
Thank you.
All right. So anyway, I went out one day and I listened for the geese, and the geese not only made a lot of noise, but they made a lot of echo. So whether, you know, what can I say? What's good for the goose is not necessarily good for the duck. But it's the best I could do.
Barbara, I think it's going to be one of those shows where Ed's just on a
roll
boy. The entire show.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, in all reality, if you think about the myth or the wives' tale that duck calls don't reflect, it really probably has to do with the fact that they're mostly lake animals. They like to be on nice, mallards in particular are dabblers, which means they kind of tilt up and eat and then they come down. They're not divers. There's divers and dabblers in the duck world. And dabblers tend to be in shallower lakes. They don't tend to be in running water. Mergansers, which are divers, would be like in a stream or a river, but mallards not so much. And because there's nothing to reflect the sound back at you if you're on a long lake, you can understand where the idea that there was no echo is born.
Interesting.
That's beautiful. I never even thought about that.
So everybody now grab your gin glass and we'll talk about the other homework.
Now, what was that homework all about?
Well, you made the comment that when you have some fancy brand of gin.
Oh.
And that you put in the freezer.
Usually Boodles.
Boodles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or Beefeater. But
and
Boodles,
that yeah. It gets...
Viscous.
Viscous.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
But it'll happen with any gin. It can be cheap gin, too.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't...
Well, I mean,
we
kind of made the joke about doing the experiments, but we'll have to do the experiments.
You didn't do the experiments. Nobody
we
did
drank
them.
A lot. We did the control experiments.
I said we did the control
we
experiments.
We used the room temperature
gin. Ice.
Right. Yeah. And you
one,
know,
one. I my experiment was with two parts gin, one part vermouth.
Mm.
Oh, that's an old. That's a really
with an
old
olive
fashioned
or
recipe.
An onion.
With an olive.
That's okay. A perfect almost.
And I noticed no increase in viscosity, although I became much more fluid myself.
No. A question.
The wife of Jim.
Yeah. Right. The question I have is there a lot of sugar in gin, and is it possible sugar in gin, and as it cools off, that would make it more viscous. Is it possible that the particular gin has too much sugar?
Well, that was our hypothesis last time we met.
Hmm.
So if any of our non-driving audience is out there and
like
wishes to do some flash freezing of gin and let us know what they find.
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend that, you know, people who already have gin on hand, don't go out and buy gin to do an experiment for this program, right?
But if you had to buy gin, it would be a good idea.
Because, you know, we need multiple experiments in science. So you have to have multiple data points. So
yes.
We've gotten through the control phase. Now we're on to
we need
the
3,000 to 4,000 people trying this to see what
no,
we get.
No, no, sir. No, sir, we do not.
Over the age of 21, please.
The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. If you have a science question on this science forum, I guess, Ed, you buy a good bottle. Jim, you buy a cheap bottle, and then Barbara,
are you giving me water?
No, you can you can buy a medium priced bottle.
I could do that.
But
I'm an associate
like the
professor.
Three bears here.
I think it might have something to do with the alcohol content too. Maybe the proof.
Yeah, but the problem is that ethanol, which is usually the proof part, doesn't really
freeze.
Get viscous
no.
at freezer temperatures.
So then a lower alcohol booze.
Well,
would become more
viscous. Yes, for sure.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jim, you
well,
like
actually, it? I mean, it's not a matter of become. It will freeze at a higher temperature.
Correct.
Yes. And that's supreme viscosity right there.
Well, yeah. But it's a pretty abrupt transition in viscosity.
Yeah.
For water, it is.
Yeah.
You get the crystals first.
So, I don't know. I think it's an interesting problem because gin is basically grain alcohol then that's run through the juniper berries, right?
Yes.
So it's not like it's extracting a lot of other stuff.
Well, the junipers are really intense. They have a lot of those phytovitamins in them. So I think we might be and pectin. So you're right. We might be kind of getting into the whole idea that it's sugars or associated
polysaccharides.
All right. Well,
there you go.
It's very obvious that much more research is needed, and I think we should put together a grant to study this.
You think so?
Yes.
This is your tax dollar at work. That's
mm-hmm.
beautiful. And, you know, 800-348-2551 is the number. Ed made a joke before we started about the Silence Forum.
We're getting there.
We're well on our way.
I think so. They're sleeping it off.
You know, since we're here and since we don't have any calls yet, there's a... There have been some very, very interesting studies done of this type. For example, there was the study as to why potato chips are more enjoyable to eat than if they're ruffled than if they're not ruffled.
And what's the answer?
And the answer to that, and it cost a lot of money to come up with this, was that when the potato chip is large enough and ruffled, though it doesn't actually go into your mouth completely, that when you chomp on it, you get the visceral sound of the crunching, and that makes it more enjoyable. This is
and,
true.
And
that
two waves of
done.
Salts. It's true. I've unfortunately read this.
Why would that visceral reaction? What does this go back to our days when we were chomping on bones? I mean, why would that increase the pleasure?
It could very well be from chomping on bones. I have not tried chomping on bones, but I'm sure that would have the same visceral enjoyment as chomping on.
Well, thankfully now the calls are starting to come in.
Oh, that's
so,
good. Maybe they wanted this to stop too.
Yeah.
I did have one other thing, too. We talked a couple shows ago about Mars, and one of the rovers that's on Mars got covered in a dust storm a
yep.
couple of years ago.
And
NASA
year.
Has been doing a Twitter feed of trying to recover the Opportunity rover.
Yeah.
Because it's the windy season on Mars, in case you missed that on your calendar. And so they're hoping that a windstorm will come and knock enough dust
off, yeah.
detritus off of the rover so that it can recharge its batteries mm-hmm. and perhaps make a little peep.
Yeah.
And if we can, we've got programs ready to send to it to tell it to go and hide from the rest of the dust storms if the one dust storm uncovers it.
And
so,
any reaction thus far?
The last Twitter feed says that the solar panels did come, or they don't know. The dust storm came through, and that there will be another series of dust storms that come between now and January. So every dust storm that passes, then they kind of send out a little, hello, are you there? And so far, they haven't heard anything yet.
You know, as I understand it, and maybe I have this wrong, but I thought the opportunity had well exceeded the amount of time it was supposed to run.
Oh, yeah. Right. Way over.
But you know what the rules actually of interplanetary space are? And it's very interesting.
No.
A number of years ago, there was a millionaire who bought one of the rovers that was on the moon.
Yeah.
And everybody laughed at him. But according to the law of interplanetary space now, is that if you own something on one of these planets, you own everything within the view of it. So this lucky guy not only owns this lunar rover, but he also owns for $50 million all the land that you can see from it.
It's old Mariner law only applied to a planet.
And who made this law and who enforces this law?
I think the pirates.
Apparently there's nobody up there to stop them.
Well, that's very interesting. And I use that term extremely loosely. Let's,
yes,
let's take a break. 800-348-2551. The calls are flowing now, and we'll get back to the science forum in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. The scientists are here at Standard, Jim Pickett, at Barbara Brabitz. Add a quick email, and then we'll jump on the phone lines. This is from Bob. There seem to be two types of hand soaps that are dispensed from hand-operated pumps. Some of these foam when they are dispensed, when you push down on the pump. The liquid inside isn't under pressure. With some brands, the container can be refilled. So it's not like shaving cream where there is a gas inside that produces foaming bubbles when the product comes out of the dispenser into an environment where there is lower pressure. What makes foaming hand soap foam, scientists?
Great question. The viscosity of the foaming soap is much less, so it's runnier than the dispenser that just puts a glop on your hand. In the actual, not the hose part that goes down into the bottom, but in the assembly in the top, you're injecting air every time you pump. And that air pushes it through a screen. And that screen is similar to like one of those multiple bubble makers that the kids get for the parties. And so you're blowing a whole bunch of tiny bubbles through, you're blowing the material through a whole bunch of tiny bubbles in this screen.
Hmm.
And then that's what comes out the other side.
She does know everything,
sounds
doesn't
good.
She?
I've dissected it to find out, could I just take my normal soap? Because
so
I like
you've
the bubbles.
Thought about this.
I like the bubbles.
Yeah.
But it's expensive because you buy this runny stuff for like too much money.
Right.
And then, so can you just cut the stuff that makes the glops in your hand with regular water
or gin,
and then stick it in the soapy dispenser? And as long as you have the top that makes the soap part.
It works?
It works.
Well, I'll be darned. You see the things you learn here? Yeah. Mark in Salem is on. Mark, you're on.
Hi. I had to give up the gin. I liked it too much.
Okay.
My question is, back in 1987, I was writing science column for the old Knickerbocker News, and I read the original report on the climate change. And the prediction was that the Northeast, our area, would have a more cloudy environment. Now, I just installed a solar hot water system on my house myself. I did it back in the 70s when Jimmy Carter was president. And it seems like we're getting a lot less direct sun. And I wonder, I don't have a pyranometer, so I wonder if the data shows that we're getting fewer days of direct sun and more days of cloudiness, regardless of the fact that it's November, I mean, year-round.
Yeah, okay. What do you think?
That's a good question. I can take that as homework and and find out.
You're going to look into that?
That's something that interests me.
There are almanacs that are out there on certain weather stations that will give you a readout of how many electron volts. Because most of the weather stations that report out have PVs. They have photovoltaic cells on them to keep them charged. And it will tell you how much sunlight they're getting, direct sunlight in a day.
All right. Jim is writing that down.
So. And I actually have a pyranometer, which I've been using for years. And unfortunately, I don't have it except for my house. But for the most part, it's about the same as it's always been.
Okay.
In fact, I can tell you that I have a lot. I have an observatory at my house as well, and I can tell you that we haven't been able to use it now for about 3 weeks, just because of the amount of clouds.
Right. Now, to answer Mark's question, though, you would need to go several
to go back,
years.
Yeah. At least 15 years back.
Let's Zach the engineer. Let's pop Mark. What the heck? Is that a rooster, Mark? What is
it
that?
Echoing?
I have a 9-month-old rooster who we put in a cage at night down in the basement so he doesn't crow, and I can't, unfortunately, he's right off my back porch.
Oh, that's okay. We like it. As a matter of fact, it makes the veins in our engineer's head. Yeah, there they go, you see? So we better let you go, Mark.
Sorry about that.
Before there's a medical emergency here. Thank you for the call. 800-348-2551. Sorry about that, Zach. Let's go to Carrie in Albany. Carrie, you're on.
Hey, I heard you talking about the viscosity of gin, and I just, there's a fun fact. I do a lot of baking and cooking, and I use alcohol when I make homemade ice cream or gelato.
Right.
It prevents it from getting too hard.
Oh.
And it livens up the party afterwards, too.
Well, yeah, maybe a little bit. You don't have to add very much, so
yeah.
Well, you really don't even detect it.
Yeah,
in the ice cream.
Yeah, I've made champagne gelato that
way.
Oh,
you have?
It just takes forever to freeze as a result.
Champagne gelato.
Yes.
That must be quite a great lifestyle for you professors, huh? That's great.
It must be his private school friends.
Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We are really off to a great start here on the old Vox Pop Science Forum. The viscosity of gin, once again. Friend of mine, John Fisher from Culinary Institute, he admonished me several years ago. I used to shake my martinis, and he said, no, you're imparting air into the, they become too frothy. And so I started stirring, and by golly, you stir it long enough with very cold ice cubes, or I don't know how cold they are, but they will get viscous regardless of the gin you use.
Well, that sounds to me, the biochemist in me, that sounds like you're denaturing something. The mechanical action, similar to making egg whites, that you're getting the proteins to tangle at the molecular level, and that causes the change in viscosity.
But here's something that you would add to that thinking, is that if you put the bottle in the freezer without shaking it
the same thing will happen.
It'll come out, gloop, 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 gloop.
Yeah, well, don't freeze an egg.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the polysaccharides, the sugar-related stuff.
Yeah.
That could do that sort of thing.
Then any booze should do that, right?
Well, it depends on what's being extracted out of the juniper berries.
Because gin is less sweet than, say, bourbon. Would the same thing happen if you put bourbon in the freezer?
Oh, that would be a crime to bourbon, wouldn't it?
I agree.
Yeah. Oh.
This is Drinks Thursday, everyone.
Well, there's probably less stuff extracted into the bourbon than there would be from, I mean, speculating now. When you're extracting through the juniper berries, there's all that good stuff in there that's going to come out.
Right. So where's the distillation process in this? Because, of course, that's going to clean everything up, and then it has to be all post-distillation.
Yeah.
So you need to add stuff. Maybe I should tell everyone that SUNY Cobleskill has a new fermentation science bachelor's degree.
Really?
Yes. Both an applied fermentation degree and a fermentation science degree. So depending on how much upper-level science you want to take.
And how old
one
you
is,
are.
Right. And you've got culinary, kind of like a culinary bent, and then you've got kind of the more nerdy stuff.
So if you wanted to make kimchi, for instance, or something.
Yes. Sure, or yogurt.
Oh, very interesting.
Or booze. We're having a distilling course that's coming on board soon.
Now, that's interesting for college kids. I mean, most of them are too young to drink, so they can't sample their wares.
They're about half and half, it turns out. College students are getting slightly older, but I'm getting older. I don't know. Anyway, it turns out that if you create, I don't want to say this wrong because we're online, if you create a class that is for, that has a purpose beyond pleasure,
yeah,
that you can partake as part of the sampling of your wares.
Ah, what a loophole that is.
Yeah, but you can't serve it. So we won't be opening up a bar with our wares anytime
soon.
All
right, well, let's go to the phones. And Ken in Hoosick Falls. Ken, you're on.
Hi, guys. So I own a distillery, Spirits of Old Bennington in Bennington, Vermont.
Terrific.
And I make gin, among other things, rum. And there's no sugar in gin.
I didn't think it was a very sweet thing.
But rum is sweet.
No, there is sugar in most rums, but there's no sugar in gin. It's just half liquor or half alcohol, half water.
But the
what
juniper
you're extracting
berries
out of the juniper is just the essence of juniper
in the distilling
but,
process.
But the
right?
essence are those phytoproteins and other molecules that could do the biochemistry.
Yeah,
that's
correct.
The question
but
is
an extremely small amount.
It doesn't take much.
So Ken, you know Bennington can get pretty cold in the winter. Do you ever leave a bottle of the gin out back and see what happens?
Yeah, liquor, alcohol does get more viscous when it gets colder.
Even the brown whiskeys? I've never really frozen a brown whiskey before.
A brown whiskey? The only thing what makes brown whiskey brown is the fact that it was in a charred barrel.
No, what I'm saying is, say a bourbon or a rum or something, if you were to put that in a freezer, would it have the similar viscosity as gin?
Or vodka?
Yes. Same thing, except if you put something with sugar. So if you put a sweetened rum or like a Rumpelmintz, it'll get very viscous in the freezer.
Sure.
So that's a clue.
Oh, okay. Somehow we got to get long chain molecules in there somewhere.
Well, Ken, thank you for the call. And what's the name of the distillery?
Spirits of Old Bennington.
Wonderful.
Yeah, great hearing from you. Thank you for calling. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Let's play a new game on the Science Forum called Science Forum Roulette, in which I spin around, and whoever I point to has to come up with a science topic. Ready? Here we go. Jim Pickett.
Oh.
Topic.
Let's talk about string theory.
Oh, my gosh. If you string a whole bunch of molecules together in cold gin, it gets...
No.
Go ahead. What do you want to say about string theory? There's some controversy about string theory.
There's controversy about string theory. The question can be, is it a legitimate scientific pursuit? Because it tends not to generate hypotheses that can be tested experimentally.
Yeah. Okay, and so?
Which is a good question. The thing about the string theory, as far as I read, I mean, being a chemist, not a physicist, is that it's just too good at answering so many questions.
Well, that's why people haven't abandoned it yet.
That, for example, gravity apparently just drops out of it very easily, which is not
true. Is that
true.
A pun?
No.
Gravity drops out of something?
I guess so. Anyway, because it explains gravity so well, and most other theories struggle with gravity, that's why it has been attractive for so long.
So I had a great question today in my class that's related to gravity, and that is, why does gravity play a role in light? Why does gravity bend light?
It doesn't bend light.
Right. What is bending light instead?
What's bending light instead is space is bending, and therefore the light is going a different direction than you would expect it to go.
And the reason why space has bent is because of gravity. So it's an indirect effect.
Come on, Jim. Come on, Jim.
We're splitting hairs here. I would say that gravity, because gravity is the warping of space, that the gravity is bending the light. You can't separate.
Right. There's no mass to light that we acknowledge, and therefore it is not a direct. If you look at the formula for gravity, it's two masses and their interactions against each other.
Well, yeah, the mass equivalent of the energy.
Correct.
And that counts.
Uh-oh, this is getting very deep now.
Yeah, I'm amazed that there's no mass involved, because you have the wave function, but photons are also discrete things, right?
Correct.
So why is there no mass?
Because there's wave-particle duality to light.
But why
says
is there
Einstein.
No mass? If a photon is a thing, why does that thing not have any mass?
Because it's energy.
Then it's not a thing.
That's right.
Well, the thing is, is that little packet of energy.
Okay.
So talking about it as a particle, what that means is that it comes in discrete amounts of energy. That you
it's like a dispenser size. You can't make it any smaller.
Okay, yeah. So to recap the program, we've discussed duck calls, string theory, light,
gin.
And gin. Let's go to the phones and see what happens now. Jim in North Pownell. Jim, you're on.
Hey there. My ancestors used to make Applejack by making hard cider and then putting the barrel outside and freezing it and then draining off what didn't freeze.
Right.
Yep.
Is that the way you do it?
That's exactly how you do it. Alcohol tends not to freeze at low temperatures, and so the water freezes first, pushing the alcohol down to the bottom of the barrel, and then you just siphon it off.
Oh, okay.
All right.
It's like freeze drying, if you will.
Because
then it does have to be aged before it becomes.
That depends how good it tastes. Sometimes it never gets to that stage. I've had it. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Well, thanks,
but,
Jim.
But when the water freezes, it freezes as essentially pure water.
Yeah.
So
whatever's
excludes,
left over in liquid form is the stuff you keep.
Yeah, it will be higher in alcohol.
Right.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, or Barbara Brabitz are here. 800-348-2551. Tony in North Adams, you're on.
Yes, I have a question for your scientist.
Okay.
I watched something over my house last night.
Yeah.
And this thing, it didn't blink like a jet.
Yeah, Tony, can you turn your radio? Tony, can you just turn your radio down just a wee bit?
Yes, please. Right. I will do so.
All right, we'll take a minute here.
Is that better?
Good. All right. Now go on. You saw something over your house last night. It didn't blink like a jet. And?
No. What? It was running from what I would call northeast up.
Uh-huh.
Is that a satellite?
Yep.
About what time was it?
All right. It was about 10:30.
What was it? Very bright? Like a
very bright.
It's probably the International Space Station.
No kidding.
Well, there's a way to check that. You could go online and check that.
Yep.
That's right.
Find out if it was over your house.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's pretty big, and it's about 100 miles up.
A couple hundred.
And so the light Tony was seeing then was
reflected from the sun.
From the sun.
Yep.
All
that's right,
Tony.
That's something that was so high up.
So did it cross the entire sky, or did it kind of blink out?
We lost him.
It crossed the entire sky. I just answered for him because he's not on the line anymore.
And how long? Now, that was my question. Assuming it's X number of miles up and it's reflecting the sun, and I've seen the ISS many times and Skylab before
it's
that.
Big.
Yeah, it is, and it's very bright. How long will we actually watch that? It sort of fades out. It's kind of fun to watch. It goes along very bright, and then it gets dimmer and dimmer,
it's about
gone.
20 seconds, I'd say.
Yeah.
From one side to the other?
Well, you can actually see it for quite some time. But then when it gets over into the Earth's shadow, then it rapidly fades out and disappears. But you can see even fairly small satellites. I mean, they're not bright like the ISS.
Yeah,
but
a lot of people don't sit outside this time of day or this time of year to watch the satellites. But it's a nice, crisp sky because you don't have a lot of heat in the sky this time of year.
To give you an idea, there's about 3,000 satellites up there.
Yeah.
And whenever I take a picture with the telescope, if I take 10 photographs with the telescope, at least two of them will have a satellite crossing the path. So there are a lot of satellites.
When you take pictures, do you have a time lapse?
Yeah, usually.
You open your lens
for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If you do longer than that, then the stars tend to sort of stretch out because the mount doesn't exactly track the sky.
So you have a computerized
system,
and it's not precise?
Well, it's as precise as I can make it. I mean, it's so precise that you maybe get an arc second of difference, which is not very much.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz. We'll take a quick break here. That's right, Zach. 800-348-2551 is the number. And then back to more of your calls coming up. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Science Forum. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. This email from Brian and Quinn in Pittsfield. I was reading an educational book that sharks about sharks to my 7-year-old son. Among many fun facts was the supposed fact that if sharks didn't exist, humans wouldn't exist. Is this true? If so, why?
Wow, those are some dots that I haven't connected. If sharks didn't exist, humans wouldn't exist.
Okay, you have 30 seconds. Go.
Sharks have been around since the Cambrian, just about, which is right. 400 million years
yes.
ago. And humans have been around for about 3 million years. So my guess is that the relationship between sharks and humans is probably pretty slim.
Well, except that sharks are an apex predator for the most part,
yes.
and they have been around a long time. So they may have done some evolutionary pruning along the way so that we could crawl out and do our darndest to breathe oxygen.
Well, there is a short, slight difference between the land mammals and the sea mammals
sure.
as far as association.
And yeah, and it goes back pretty far, so.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, thank you for that one. This one's from Mark. There are many stories of people who try to raise wild pets, wild animals as pets. It seems to work for a while until the animal one day mauls the owner. Why is it that some animals can't be domesticated while others can?
Well, are you three married?
Oh, you see, now that was a shot, wasn't it?
Well, no, I think there's a certain part of captivity that runs against some nature.
It's Barbara Bravitz.
Yeah, my husband's listening.
That's fine.
But I think at a certain point, captivity is an instinct that we're not used to and that we have to fight against being captured.
Yeah, well, it's also a matter of, it is selection necessary to domesticate an animal. I mean, there's the famous experiment in which the Russian experiment, basically domesticating foxes.
Yeah.
Which you take a fox, which is a pretty wild animal.
Right.
We tried to have a pet fox once on the farm.
Okay.
And it got about half grown and then it took off.
Went off on its own.
But when they were selecting for the foxes, which were most gentle around people.
Yeah.
After, I don't know, a dozen generations, they started producing foxes, which started to be a lot like dogs.
Oh, okay.
In which they looked like more like dogs and stuff. So it's a matter of the things which probably make an animal successful in the wild are not necessarily the things that make them successful around people.
So,
but those traits exist in many animals and can be bred out.
And it's funny because you kind of run that gamut. If you want a cat, right, and you're using them as a utilitarian animal of the farm, you want them to have the prey instinct. You want them to be able to eliminate your vermin.
Right.
But at a certain point, you don't want them to swat you every time you try to pull a tick off their neck.
Right.
Right? Or try to disentangle them from a barbed wire fence. You want them to have some cuddle factor, if you will. Now, a former student of mine, who I'm a friend of on Facebook, is in the process of domesticating a kestrel. So he does falconry. And this kestrel is relatively new to the family, and he was explaining the process that you keep them on a leather lead as you teach them that if they want good food, that they're to come to the hand
right.
where you're going to get nice, fresh, prime meat
yeah.
as opposed to going out and trying to kill something and maybe getting it or maybe not.
Yeah.
And eventually you don't have to keep the lead on anymore because the animal will understand I got a good thing going here.
Right.
If I want prime meat, all I have to do is be with the food guy, the one with the glove on, and he's got the meat. So at that point, it isn't that isn't a generational difference because that's a bird that learns that if you want a sure thing, the sure thing is the guy with the glove.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Walter in Westfield. Walter, you're on.
Hello. I had two things. One was a question about alcohol. You were talking about gin not having any sugar in it. And I happened to be talking about this with my brother the other day, and he said that alcohol was a sugar. And he has more, you know, background in biology than me, so I was just curious whether he was right or whether it's not a sugar.
Alcohol is not a sugar.
However,
okay.
They do make what are called alcohol sugars, which are artificial sweeteners. So like if you put sucralose in your tea or something like that, that is an alcohol sugar, but that is not the typical form of ethanol that we have that are out there. What ethanol is a modified end product of a microbe chewing on sugars. They once were sugars, then a microbe ate them, and what's left over is alcohol.
Does it break down into sugars?
No, what? It's kind of the breakdown product of sugar. It's the other way around. It's the waste material after sugars have been eaten.
Chemically, you could, I mean, if you really wanted to make the argument, you could say that alcohol is a C1 sugar. But
What's a C1 sugar?
Well, C1 meaning one carbon.
Ah, okay.
I mean, the common sugars that we have are six carbons or five carbons.
Yeah, you can get to four.
Yeah.
And would you do that, Jim? Would you make that characterization?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, there you go, Walter.
Depends
thank
how much you
very
had
much.
To drink.
We go over to James in Hudson. James.
Okay. This is a hypothetical question. In science fiction movies and books, and everyone walks around like really comfortably on their spaceships, and we know that centrifugal force works in order to create artificial gravity. But since we don't know a lot about gravity in the future, would it be possible to create artificial gravity or artificial antigravity?
Well, actually, the centripetal force is probably the closest you're going to get to gravity out in space. Basically, gravity is the distortion of space-time by mass, and you would not have enough mass in a spaceship ever to have an artificial gravity associated with it. So it's more a case that by centripetal force, you're actually being forced against the edge of the spaceship, and that's what gives you the feeling that it's gravity, but it's not gravity in itself.
Yeah, but And the artificial gravity on the Starship Enterprise would require new physics. There's nothing in currently known in physics that would allow that. But that doesn't say that there can't be new physics, but
yeah,
doesn't seem
120
like
years ago, we didn't know about quantum physics, and now we do. So there may be physics out there that allows us to create something like an artificial gravity, but we have no clue, no hint of what it could be.
James, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Michael in Rhinebeck. Michael.
Hi. So I'm glad we're talking about gravity again, because I'm listening, and I my understanding is that the same warp in space-time affects mass as well as light, and that's what gravity is.
Yes, it's the mass component.
And all of the light that we see comes from the fusion of matter, or most of it, at least the light that we're talking about. So I'm hoping you can clarify that difference for me that you guys were talking about.
Well, any kind of mass will have gravity. The light that you're getting from go ahead.
No, because it warps space-time.
Yeah, and that's just a property of mass.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What you're talking about in fusion and seeing light is in an extremely massive object like a star, you can get enough pressure to cause hydrogen atoms or other kinds of atoms, the nuclei, to join together. And in so doing, it releases a lot of heat or energy, and that eventually makes its way out of the star as light.
Mm-hmm. But it basically is the same stuff in a differently organized way as the hydrogen atoms that are being fused and releasing that energy.
Well, their mass, so they have the effect of warping space and causing gravity. And they can also fuse and make light. There are other atoms which can't fuse and make energy. Hydrogen is one that does.
But not all light comes from fusion reactions.
Most of the light we're talking about seeing, I guess what I'm trying, the way I understand it is that light is so much less organized in terms of its, that it doesn't necessarily warp space-time in any way that we would associate with mass, but it's the same stuff in just a different level of intensity.
All right, one scientist to wrap it up, and then we'll move on, Michael. Go ahead. Who wants this? Ed, you look like you're ready.
Well, light doesn't have mass, resting mass, in its own, so it's not going to warp space-time as such. In fact, it actually travels along space-time, which is what the idea of gravitational lensing and such produces. So I'm not really quite sure where to go from there.
All right, Michael, thanks for the call. Good one. Let's go to Kevin in Averill Park. Kevin, you're on.
Good afternoon. I'm going to dumb it down after that last question.
Fair enough.
Talking about distillation, can gluten survive distillation?
No.
Do gluten survive distillation?
No, but there's a lot of modifications after distillation to what we consider to be alcohols that are, you know, okay, quality.
So if something is, say, as pure as, say, a vodka, and people say, I have to have a gluten-free vodka, there's nothing added to it except for water. A lot of times they add distilled water to, because it might come out of the still at a higher proof, so they water it down with distilled water, but there wouldn't be any gluten remaining after distillation.
No.
But vodka isn't pure distillate. There is stuff that's added afterwards.
Okay. I was always the understanding it was just going to be water to bring it back. I guess, maybe the base of a lot of the cheaper alcohols are what they call neutral grain spirits.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm wondering if in that process, if it would just come out gluten-free.
Well, I think gluten-free is a term that's used kind of to someone's commercial advantage, shall we say.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Water's gluten-free.
I guess depending on the design of the still, it's always possible that you can get some carryover of stuff.
Yeah.
Because I have some gluten-free.
In principle, there shouldn't be, but things happen.
Right, okay, in kind of the way that you can get, like, the peanuts may contain nuts or peanuts in something that has nothing to do with nuts or peanuts.
Yeah. All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551, the number, and James and Beacon. James. Hello. James, are you there? We lost him. You know, he waited 10 minutes to get
out. Oh, no, just to hang
Sorry,
up
James.
On us.
Joseph in Massachusetts. Joseph.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I was wondering, when I store food in a plastic freezer bag and I press the air out of it and seal it, after time, say a month or two or 3 months, the bag is full of air and it even seems like there's pressure inside the bag. What causes that?
It's because air actually goes through that thin plastic pretty darn fast.
Plastic isn't airproof?
Not really.
Not as much as you would think it is.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That air and water can make it through slowly. So over the course of weeks and months and years, a significant amount can get through.
If you had like a Mylar bag, that would be much more airproof than like a typical polyethylene Ziploc bag.
Because they make balloons out of Mylar.
Well, Mylar is a much denser material, and so you don't get the diffusion.
Yeah, the other thing that happens, of course, is that if you put stuff in a bag like that, it's going to dehydrate to some extent as it freezes and thaws, and so you have a much higher vapor pressure on in the inside from the water.
So that creates a headspace with air in it.
Exactly.
All right, now I understand James in Beacon is back with us. James, you're on.
Hi, I have a question about the dual function of light. I think you had mentioned it earlier, and whether a proton will act as either a particle or a wave. And I know there was a famous experiment, and I don't know if an answer to why the behavior change was ever explained, but from my understanding, depending on the observable element in the experiment, a proton would either act as a wave
or a
particle.
It's a photon, not a proton, because a proton is
experiment.
Yeah, a proton's mass. That's just a hydrogen ion. But a photon is that particle of light that we look at, and it's that that wave particle duality, and the very famous experiment with the slits.
And basically, if you do your experiment to prove that it's a wave, you'll find a wave. If you do the experiment to prove that it's a particle, you'll get the data that shows that it's a particle.
And the act of observing it, because it's such a low energy state, seems to influence what your answer is.
Yeah. And the way to think about that, it really is that it's not a chunk of stuff, like a little BB. It is a packet of energy. And so that it, rather than coming as a continuous wave, it comes in these packets of energy.
All right.
So you can't get just a little bit of a photon. You either get the whole bit or none.
All right.
Yeah, and it's really hard to do it on the radio, too, because there's actually a great YouTube video that I'm going to show my students in about a week. That's a cartoon from the 90s that reproduces the famous double slit experiment and then shows the strangeness, if you will, of quantum mechanics that allows one thing to have two properties simultaneously but only express one.
And, of course, as far as this question was concerned, we don't know why it does that.
Yeah.
No. It's the strangeness of the quantum world. Anything that is almost massless or massless behaves with these odd sets of physical parameters that we only discovered about 100 years ago.
And we're beginning to realize that things that are really, 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 really big also don't follow physical laws quite the way they're supposed
Maybe
to.
Maybe our physical laws aren't exactly all they're cracked up to be.
We need some more physics.
They're the ones that we can understand because they're our scale. But when you get to very large scales, things change, and very small scales, things change.
And the grand unified theory is the piece that ties them all together, and Stephen Hawking died, so we're not really sure who's going to take up the mantle on that one.
Oh, I've got a gut feeling we never will. That was a physics
G-U-T
joke.
G-U-T, gut.
Okay, we have about a minute here. Bonnie and Poughkeepsie, you're the last one today.
Hi there. I had a question about what you were saying earlier about how gravity affects space, which then affects light. Mm-hmm. And my understanding was that space was a vacuum, so I'm confused as to how gravity affects space.
Well, space in a dimension that we don't even quite understand is more like a latex sheet, if you will, that can bend as a result of putting mass upon it. In fact, in my class, what I usually use is a giant latex sheet, and I put a big piece of mass on the inside.
A bowling ball or something.
A bowling ball, and it bends space as a result, and things are able then to be attracted or repelled by it, which is gravity. So we don't quite understand because it's not within our dimensions to really understand what's going on.
But we can see the empirical evidence
we can
that
see
this
the proof
exists,
of it.
Right, because our orbits go around a more massive object. Earlier in the universe, we probably did not have these semicircular orbits. It was probably much more erratic. But now that time has kind of cleaned out the real estate, we're back up to orbits that are semicircular.
And we are back to the end of the program. Thanks, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander for being here. Support comes from George Heigel Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in buying and selling antique collections for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And the Open Door Bookstore, Schenectady, New York, presenting Anne O'Brien Corelli, signing Skylark and Wall Creeper, Saturday, November 10th, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m., opendoor-bookstore.com, 518-346-2719. Well, that's it for the show. Thanks again to Barbara, Ed, and Jim for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Jesse King. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the fun folks from Rolling Rock Farm will be here with their latest seasonings and spices. Right now, stand by for news.